Hello, welcome. My name is Aaron Gustafson, and I am an accessibility and web standards evangelist for Microsoft. I work a lot with the Edge team. And lately I've been doing a lot of work with progressive web apps and such. But today I want to talk to you about building great web experiences, and specifically building great web experiences for any device, so not making any assumptions about what our users are using to access the web. So back in 2016, there were all of these headlines about mobile overtaking desktop. And it did happen. You know, the stats actually show that it did happen, that all of a sudden mobile users or mobile traffic exceeded the traffic that was taking place from desktop. But I'd like to challenge that assumption, because while it is true that mobile accounts for, according to Stone Temple, 56% of all traffic, that actually doesn't, it's not equal, or not equally distributed at least, across all of the different verticals that different websites and apps exist in. So in the food and drink category, mobile dominates, but it's about a 50-50 split in the news space. And in finance, it's actually 60 split towards desktop usage. And this shouldn't be surprising. People use their phones to look up restaurants, find their hours, find their menus, that sort of thing, mobile ordering. They often do their finances at their desk, right, where a larger screen can be helpful to look at big spreadsheets and such. Desktop users, you might be surprised to learn, actually spend more time on a site, around 60%. And the actual range is broken down by industry, range all the way up to 300% more time spent on particular sites. So in the case of food, it's about 57% more time spent on a site on desktop. News, it's 238% more time is spent on the sites in a desktop environment. And in finance, it's about 77%. There's a lot of debate as to the value in tracking bounce rates, so you can take this with a grain of salt, but bounce rates are lower on desktop than they are on mobile. Again, probably not surprising. People have a lot less patience on small screens than they do on their desktop. So they want to get in, find what they need to do, or accomplish whatever task it is that they need to accomplish, and then they want to move on to whatever the next thing is that they need to do. Or they may not find what they're looking for right away and just bounce away anyway because they get frustrated, right? And they go to a competitor. Desktop users actually view more pages as well in their sessions, so by about 59%. And again, keeping with food, news, and finance, food, they view about 1.9 times the number of pages, so almost two times the number of pages that they do on mobile. News, it is two times what they spend on mobile, and finance, it's about 1.7 times. But the range actually goes from about 1.5 times for reading books, so 1.5 times of reading books longer on desktop or more pages of books on desktop, to sports being actually over three times the number of pages. So it really varies. So depending on what it is that you're building, it's important to look at these sorts of numbers. But what all of this kind of comes together to mean is that the desktop experience actually really still matters. Okay, you might be surprised to learn that web is actually the number one activity on Windows, whether it's in the browser or some other sort of HTML-powered parts of the operating system. It's by far the number one activity on Windows PCs. And desktop matters even more in the context of PWAs. We often hear progressive web apps discussed in the context of mobile, but they do matter on desktop as well. We'll be hearing from Josh from Starbucks in a moment, but Starbucks actually found that 40% of their order ahead transactions were coming from the Starbucks PWA on the desktop. So they're not even really promoting it as a desktop destination, but that's true, and they don't even have this. This is despite having higher mobile traffic numbers, actually, and without having an installable PWA on a desktop system right now. And Carnival Cruise Line actually saw a significant push notification adoption on desktop. So 16% opt-in for push notifications, which is actually quite high. And PWAs on desktop is still sort of an emerging area. But this is really promising, starting to show that, PWAs really do have a lot to gain on the desktop as well. So here at Microsoft, we believe that the web can and should reach beyond the browser, which is why we're so heavily invested in making PWAs successful on Windows. And we're not alone in this. Google and Mozilla are all bringing PWAs to the desktop as well. Apple's starting to, get interest in this too. And while this session is not exclusively about PWAs, we do have a number of sessions here at Build that are about PWAs. So I'm gonna throw those up on the screen briefly here, take a picture of this. If you haven't grabbed them all off of the schedule builder yet, there are a lot of great talks here that will be getting into the weeds of progressive apps a bit more. Everybody got it that wanted to? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right. While this session isn't PWA focused, I think PWAs actually provide a good framework for the discussion, because PWAs start with a great web experience and then enhance that experience for performance, for resilience, for installation, and for engagement. Now, the really important pieces here are that PWAs are an enhancement, okay? And an enhancement means you have to start with something, and that something that you need to start with is a great web experience. So before you experiment with service workers and the web app manifest and such, you really need to start with a great web experience, and that's ultimately what I'm here to talk to you about today. Now, the hallmarks of a great web experience include universal availability. That means over any network, on any device, and in any browsing context. It also means universal accessibility, so not having any barriers between your users and your content, and not having any barriers between your users and interacting with the products that you're building. So the first word in progressive web apps is progressive. That's the P, right? And with good reason. Progressive means to be developing gradually or in stages, to be proceeding step by step. So what does that actually look like when it comes to web products? Let's tuck into that. So the first step is to focus on what matters about your product. So if we take a trip back in time, this was Forbes.com in 2007. This is an article page. And the there that somebody is coming here for is that bit of white down there in the bottom, what, maybe like 10% of the screen? The core purpose of this page was to come here and read the content, but the content is completely hidden by all of these other things that are, drawing your attention away from the actual purpose of the page. So the actual page content is at a distinct disadvantage when it came to this. Now, most of us, all of us, hopefully, have learned from this, have learned that this is not a good way to throw everything up on the screen, to not fill every inch of real estate with content that distracts users. We've gotten a bit more focused, and I think that, mobile first as a concept has really helped us to focus on that, because when we start to think about narrow screens, it really forces us to focus on what the most important tasks are in the experience. So mobile first isn't saying that mobile is better or that that's what we should really be, you know, concerned with building. It's not mobile only. It's just a mindset. It's a framework for thinking about the experiences we build. Imagining you only have a limited canvas to work with. Now, it helps in the mobile context, certainly, but it also helps on desktop too, where we resize apps and put them side by side and stuff like that, right? So what mobile first asks us to do is, it forces us to ask questions like, why is the user here, right? What tasks do they need to accomplish? Is there anything on the screen that distracts from them being able to accomplish those tasks? In some of the Microsoft documentation, you can sometimes see this referred to as inductive user interface. That's what we sometimes call it, but it's very much in line with the idea of mobile first thinking. So we need to remember that text is actually the first interface. You know, a lot of times we get kind of caught up in the neat interaction effects that we can, create on the web these days, but the reality is that text is the first interface. So it's important to think, okay, is the copy written clearly? Does it use language that our users will easily understand? Is the copywriting voice appropriate to our organization? Does it strike the right tone? Right? We often lose sight of it, but language influences how people use and think about our products. It can create friction in a user journey, or it can foster delight. How you talk to your users matters because it makes them care or not about your product. This is often we developers struggle with. So if you're looking for somewhere to start, I highly recommend checking out MailChimp's Voice and Tone. It's at voiceandtone.com. Or there's a great book by Nicole Fenton and Kate Kiefer-Lee called Nicely Said. Those are fantastic resources for learning about good copywriting. So once we've focused, we should flip it around and ask, are there things that are missing that we could add to help our users be more successful? Examples of that include helper text, placeholders, and things of that note. Now, I'm going to turn it over for a moment to Josh Williams from Starbucks, invite him up here, to share a little bit about their process for finding focus in their product. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks. So I'm Josh Williams, product manager at Starbucks. Wanted to talk a little bit about our journey in figuring out what matters to our customers. It's pretty hard to figure out where to start, especially if you're thinking about transitioning technologies, thinking about building your first PWA, or really re-envisioning what your web experience for your customers should look like. So this was not an easy journey to figure out, but we really started out with focusing on that app-like experience, that PWA-led thought, mobile-first thinking. What does that really transform into what our customers actually want to do on web? So it turns out customers actually want to do things on web. When it comes to our usage that we saw on Starbucks.com, we saw a lot of customers spending a majority of their time on menu sections, on account management-related activities, on sending e-gifts to friends, on reloading their Starbucks card, checking their star balances, a lot of those transactional components. When I say transactional too, I really am talking about mobile first. I'm talking about interaction, app-like interaction, not necessarily purchasing, but doing something and using our web app as a tool to in and out use along their day. So yeah, customers like to do things with the features that we build. So we focus on our key customer journeys. So for us, if you know about Starbucks, if you've ever purchased a coffee, if you've seen any of our advertisements or any of the in-store placements, our rewards program is kind of a big deal. It matters a lot to us. It matters a lot to our customers. It's a way that purchasing products becomes more real and exciting and fun. You earn stars every time you make a transaction. So we wanted to think about how do customers join and onboard into that experience. Also, we wanted to focus on the financial transactions of enabling customers to purchase coffee, really big for our customers. And then also, when you think about that rewards program, how do customers actually track their progress towards completion of earning one of their free drinks or their free products? So these are, at a high level, these are the main journeys that we are focusing on. And you know, we have so many web pages out there as a retail company. I'm sure some of you in the industry can understand what it looks like. Figuring out just these customer journeys was actually a pretty significant decision because it really cut out a lot of other areas we could be working on, but we wanted to focus on what the customer was telling us that they actually wanted to spend their time on. So believe it or not, any retailer, you're going to go to their website and you're going to see a little store locator. You're going to find some way to find the nearest Starbucks store, retail store, whatever it is. So we actually started with the store locator. Now, we have a lot of engineers who are transitioning technologies and trying to figure out what the heck even is a PWA. How do I build with it? How do I take a feature that we already have and use, start with that, learn about it, and then move on from there? So this is one of those areas you can start to see, even the way we built this, we didn't even introduce the entire new design language that we use with our web app. We actually still have it chromed in within our previous website's Chrome. So from there, though, then again, we talked high level about the features we were going to focus on. Then we started going one by one, focusing on, all right, let's rebuild our sign-in page. Let's rebuild in our account create process. Even simple components like OAuth connection and granting OAuth permissions, rebuilding one of those so that we can learn more about the technology and also hone in on our overall web experience. And then getting to barcode pay, that's something that led to one of the biggest, our biggest successes in the mobile area. We brought barcode pay into the web, so it was easy to take your mobile phone, walk into a store, and pay for your coffee and earn stars. And then also e-gift and account management. So these are the areas we started to snowball and building in more and more features that were heavily transactional focused, and the features that our customers were just using every single day. So again, you start to see, all right, we have a few of these components. Now it's becoming its own thing. We actually were building this functional app. You can go to app.starbucks.com and actually see what it looks like. And it eventually culminates into a web app, something that is fully functional, something that you can actually go in, and this is one of the features that we built the web app around. It was actually order ahead, traditionally something that only existed on our iOS and Android native apps. We brought it to web. And I'm showing it in the desktop view here because it's such an immersive experience. There is not the 10% content focus. There is a full browser. In fact, we have a lot of white space to really help the customer guide their visual language through navigation, back navigation, all the way through primary content areas down to key actions in the bottom right-hand corner. So you can see how over time, with narrowing down our vision and refining our vision of what we were trying to build, we focus on key customer journeys. We focus on learning how to build with these new technologies, and then ultimately leading to something that customers can use on a day-to-day basis. And Aaron, back to you.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Thanks.
That's great. Thanks. Thanks.
Appreciate it.
So once we've focused on what it is that we need to build, once we've focused on what it is that matters, what our users are there for, we can begin looking for ways to enhance that experience. And so the first way that we can begin doing that is by using markup appropriately, so using markup that supports that experience. If the words we choose matter, the markup that we choose to kind of ensconce those words matters just as much. So I'm going to throw up some quick HTML now. This is what I would call a bunch of div soup, right? It's just meaningless divisions of the page in order to accomplish certain design things using different class names and stuff like that. But it provides no additional context or meaning to the document. So I want to walk through it step by step and talk about how we could use better semantics to make this more meaningful and to really enhance that baseline text experience to improve it for our users. So here we have the outer division, which marks up a piece of self-contained content. In this case, it is a teaser for a blog post, right? Or it's a full blog post, rather. So it's a piece of self-contained content. That could be marked up in an article element as opposed to a div. Article actually has that explicit purpose. And changes like this can be relatively easy, especially if you're using some sort of class-based CSS naming structure like BEM or SMAX or something like that. You can just leave that class in place, and it doesn't affect any of the way your document's styled. Moving on, here we have the title of this particular blog post. So it should be marked up as a heading. We have a bunch of different heading levels available to us. H1 elements are for the most important headings on the page, so we might choose to use an H1. Moving down, we have meta content about the document. So footer is an option for this because that's really for marking up sort of meta information like this. But because this is multiple pieces of data, so it's got a publish date and it's got reading time for it, a definition list is actually a really good option here. They aren't only for use in things like glossaries, and they can be used for any time you have a key value pair that you want to mark up in the document, and it creates explicit associations between the elements. So you can see in the first row there, DT published, and then a DD. So the DT is the term, and the DD is what's defining that, okay? And these even have flexibility to have multiple DTs that are defined by a single DD, or multiple DDs that act as definitions for a single DT, or multiples and multiples. It's really, really flexible, which is cool. So little side bonus, we could actually mark up the date information in a time element. Time would indicate that is taking place at a certain time or date, or even in a duration of time. We could use time around the 25 minutes as well. And we can even use things like the date time attribute on the time element to provide an expansion, a machine readable expansion, which could allow us to do some interesting things that I'll note later on. Moving down into the actual meat, the content, here we have lines of text separated by line breaks. And the number of sites I've seen this on still boggles my mind. But this doesn't really provide any meaning about what this content is. This is paragraphs, right? So we could mark them up in divs, which would make them at least lay out on top of one another in a block. But because they're paragraphs, we should be using paragraph elements. And there are all of these great semantic elements like paragraphs, lists, and so on and so forth that all add meaning to the document and then ultimately provide more accessibility benefits for our users in the end. And they give us a lot more flexibility in being able to do things with that content later on. Now, some of you in the audience may be wondering, okay, but with CSS I can make it all look the same anyway, so why should I care? Right? Why does it matter what my markup is? Well, what happens if for some reason your CSS doesn't reach the user? Maybe it's on a CDN that all of a sudden is unreachable or goes down for some reason. What you would end up if you just had the div soup version is something that looks like this. Whereas if you had semantic markup in place, the browser default styles would actually make it much more readable. So you're providing a better baseline experience for your users if something goes wrong, which happens on occasion. Poor semantics is actually an exclusionary design choice, which causes a mismatch between the structure that a sighted person can infer and the structure that's actually available to someone who uses assistive technologies like a screen reader. We actually create accessibility issues when we as designers fail to consider the variability of human experience. Using good semantics helps you to build that consideration in from the beginning because meaning is conveyed in multiple ways, both visually, non-visually, and so on and so forth. Standardization, because all of the browsers support these standardized elements, means it can be understood by a broader audience. It also means that from an accessibility standpoint, all of the kind of underpinnings in order to provide that more accessible experience, provide all those correct accessibility mappings and such, that's all on the browser and the operating system rather than something that we have to shoulder ourselves. And most of the semantic elements that exist out there, form controls and such as well, provide usefulness via different interaction methods for free without having to add any additional code to make it happen. So it's all about being able to design for more people and reach more people, reach a broader audience, create more opportunities for people to interact with our content. Now, it also allows our content to do more. So when we have semantic markup, we could say something like, hey, Cortana, read me the top three headlines in today's New York Times. So it could query NewYorkTimes.com, capture the first headline of the first three article elements within, let's say, the top news ID'd element. Or it could even grab all of the articles on the page and find the latest three using the time element and parsing the machine-readable time, date and time that's on there. So your code, this is just a little sample of JavaScript, but basically what you end up doing is some query selector JavaScript chicanery in order to extract that information and do something fun with it. Another thing that's really important is that good markup makes your sites more resilient because it reduces the dependencies that your sites have. So I'm going to give a simple example of a button, right? Probably one of the simplest interactive elements on the page. Say you want a button that's able to submit a form. There are four potential ways. There's probably more, but there's four that I'm going to cover, four ways that you could possibly mark this up. You could do it as an input with a type of submit. You could do it as a button element with a type of submit. You could do it as an anchor, maybe with a class of button on it. or you could do it as a div with a class of button on it. Okay? Now, visually, you might be able to make these look identical, but the reality is that they're not all created equal. If we were to compare them across a variety of different qualities, you'd see that the input button is displayed as a button by default. Okay? It has the semantics of being a button by default. It is focusable via the keyboard, which is important for assistive technologies, and also for power users who spend a lot of time on the keyboard. It can be activated by a mouse, by touch, by the enter key, or by the space bar. And it's capable of submitting a form. The same is true of an input of type submit. A link, however, is displayed as a link by default, not a button. It is just a named generic in terms of the semantic accessibility tree. It is focusable, and it's activatable by the mouse, touch, and enter, but not the space. So that's a discrepancy. It's a UX gap. And it's not capable of submitting forms. The div is even worse because it's just a block-level element by default. It's not exposed via the accessibility tree at all in terms of its semantics because it doesn't mean anything. It's not focusable, it's not activatable, and it can't submit a form. So what we end up with is a bunch of UX gaps that need to be filled by more code, right? So what we end up with is introducing more dependencies. So we now have a CSS dependency in order to make the anchor and the div display as though they are buttons. We have ARIA that we need to introduce in order to make sure that the accessibility API understands the anchor are acting as buttons. We need to add extra HTML to the div in order to make it focusable using tab index. And then we need to introduce JavaScript as an additional dependency in order to control the activation of those elements and to submit the form. So all of this is just creating more potential points of failure for just this one interface element, right? It's just making it a more and more fragile experience. And the reason I say this is because we don't actually control what happens to our code once it leaves our server. We don't control the networks that it travels along and who might manipulate our content, inject ads into it, or block JavaScript or what have you. We don't control the execution environment, the device a user is on. We don't control the browser that they happen to use. It's the Wild West out there. There are a lot of unknowns. And so we should be striving to build great experiences that are resilient and are able to work, even if some of our dependencies aren't met. I'll talk a little bit about how we think smartly about dependencies in a few minutes. I mentioned the CDN going down. There could be errors in our code. There could be errors in third-party code that we're bringing into our pages that cause issues, cause some of these dependencies to not be met. Plugins can cause problems. Input methods can cause problems if we're not taking care of those. And actually, I got this tweet from a colleague of mine, Michael Spellacy, the other day. He looped me in on this somewhat terrifying thing that happened. So in case you weren't following the news, Chrome 66 is when Google landed their effectively distrust for semantic SSL certificates that were issued before June 1st of 2016. So what happened is if your site was running on HTTPS and you were using a CDN, as his company was, that had an SSL certificate issued by Semantic, all of a sudden when Chrome 66 hit that page, it no longer trusted that as a secure site. So it's going to go ahead and block any requests for security reasons to those assets. So all of a sudden, 200 of his employer's sites did not have CSS, did not have JavaScript, right? They were just reduced to plain old semantic HTML. But most of them were able to still work, which is pretty incredible. And that's what we should be striving to build. Now, this is not the first time that this sort of thing has happened. And in fact, the very next day, the jQuery CDN had an issue where their SSL certificate expired, and anyone who was pulling in jQuery from the jQuery CDN over HTTPS all of a sudden lost jQuery, and if their site was wholly dependent on jQuery, dead in the water, right? This stuff happens. Sky in the UK blocked the jQuery CDN as malware a couple years ago, and so all of their customers just their customers, but all of their customers, and they're the largest provider in the UK, did not get jQuery for like a day. Okay, this stuff happens, and we need to be aware of the fact that we don't control a lot of stuff. So that's kind of a downer, right? Like, we want to have as much control as possible. So let's flip things around. Instead of thinking about it as a downer, let's think about it as building a great core experience and then using those tools, JavaScript, CSS, et cetera, to enhance our core experiences that work no matter what, right? So instead of trying to basically cobble together a bunch of dependencies in order to overcome a UX problem caused by the fact that we just didn't choose good semantic markup, let's actually use markup that will work regardless and then, you know, enhance with JavaScript and such as we can, optionally. So I'm going to walk through a quick, simple example of how we can do something like this. So here we have a basic input field for an email type, okay? So in here, we have the type equals email. This was introduced in HTML5, and it actually creates some interesting experience deltas for our users. First, there's whether or not the browser supports the email input type at all. If it doesn't, the user just gets a plain old input. It falls back beautifully, elegantly to a normal input, which is what we had for 15 years before we got the HTML or the email input type. Then there's the question of whether the browser has the HTML5 validation algorithm in place. If it does, then the user will actually be notified if their email address is not a valid email address. We don't have to write any of that JavaScript logic to do it, a lot of which gets written really poorly and keeps barfing at my address because I have a hyphen in the URL, right? So we don't have to maintain those regular expressions anymore. The browser can do it for us, which is fantastic. A third delta is if we're in a situation where the browser has a virtual keyboard, it can present the most appropriate keyboard to our users. So they get the at symbol in there, they get shortcuts like .com and such, and they can more quickly enter things like their email address or enter numbers or what have you. There are a bunch of email field or a bunch of input types that came in HTML5 that allow us to do this sort of thing. Moving on, we have the required attribute. So that was just one attribute with all of those deltas, right? So here we have the required attribute. This was also introduced in HTML5 and indicates that this field is required. So if somebody does have support for the HTML5 validation algorithm, if they don't fill in anything in this field, they'll actually be prompted and they won't be able to submit the form without it being filled in. Okay. Now, the last little bit there, ARIA required equals true. This is for the accessible rich internet application spec, and it notifies assistive technology that this is a required field. Now, hopefully in the future, this will be mapped over to required automatically, but for right now, this is what we have. So in order for this to actually be exposed to somebody who's using assistive technology, the browser first needs to expose it to the operating system and to the assistive technology via understanding what the ARIA required property is, and then the assistive tech needs to actually know what to do with that. So the user may get this enhancement or they may not, but it's pretty easy to provide for them. So if we were to kind of graph this along the idea of enhancing the experience, we text input, and then we move up to having the required validation, required notification, email validation, and notification would go along with that, and then a dedicated keyboard, all of which are enhancing just this single component, all just through adding three particular attributes to an input type. That's a great way to enhance things. So when you begin to think of user experience as a continuum that scales with capabilities, this progressive approach to interfaces is both elegant and powerful. All right, moving on after markup. Once we've got good semantic markup in place, we can begin to think about how design can enhance that core experience. So if you were to think about this same arc in the concept of layout, for instance, maybe you think about it as block layout and then floats and then positioning, media queries, flexbox, and grid. Right? This is a nice, simple arc of how you can use different CSS approaches in a progressively enhanced way. And interestingly, this is totally possible to do within the same page. So Manuel Matovich created this demo as part of a Smashing Magazine article. And what he wanted to show is that you could start with a block-based layout, and then you could have floated styles, and then you could also have in that same CSS some Flexbox-related styles and some grid-related styles. And based on what the browser understood, because different levels of browser or different levels of modernity, however you want to say it, within browsers have different levels of support for these different CSS features. And the cool thing is, if you use Flexbox, it throws out float. If you use grid, it throws out Flexbox and float-related layout styles. So these are made to be stacked on top of one another and can be done really easily. I'll show how this sort of thing works from a technical standpoint shortly. So I love this quote from Jeff Veen. I've been amazed at how often those outside the discipline of design assume that what we designers do is decoration, likely because so much bad design is decoration. Good design isn't. Good design is problem solving. Now, if you consider yourself a developer, I would say that you are also a designer. Whether you consider yourself a graphic designer or not, you're still a designer because you are solving problems, right? And design is there to solve problems. It's not just there as decoration, which is an important thing to note. Now, there are a number of tools that we have within the realm of graphic design that help to provide meaning and structure within our documents, that help to illuminate, really, the content and the purpose of our interfaces. I don't have time to get deep into all of these. I'm going to pick on a couple of them to focus on and give a couple of examples of, just so that you're starting to think about them. So Starbucks uses alignment to a great degree, and they do a wonderful job with this. And alignment helps our eyes to move more efficiently over interfaces and to go from one point to another and to make sense of things. Medium does a great job with contrast. Contrast is used to draw our eyes to more important areas and away from less important areas. How we size elements with relation to one another can actually help layouts feel more natural, such as in the golden ratio, which is employed here in the Trivago layout. That's proportion. Proximity can help us to group related elements. So you can see in this form, there's a little bit of space between the email field and the password label, and the labels are closer to than the fields are to each other. So it helps us to logically group email with the email field, password with the password field in a visual way. There are semantic ways to do that as well. A consistent vertical rhythm can actually make a layout feel more structured, and it can improve the overall readability of your documents. And unity, for example, repeating a color throughout a design can make an interface feel more cohesive. I don't know how many of you have been on sites where like buttons are umpteen different colors and in different styles. Some look like they're 3D, some are flat design. Obviously, it's something that's become a Frankenstein's monster as it's been updated over time. We want to have consistency in our designs. We want to have unity. It makes our users feel better about our products. Now, graphic design is traditionally focused on print, but many of these considerations apply equally within the web space. But while the web can be print-like, the web is not print. And so there are some additional considerations that we need to be aware of as well, such as screen size, resolution, brightness, the color density of the device we're on, user preferences, network speed and quality, and assistive technology. Now, some of these are fairly straightforward in terms of what tech we have for addressing them. So screen size, responsive layouts, using media queries, really easy way to address the variability of screen sizes. I highly recommend starting mobile first, which I'll show you an example of momentarily. For differing resolutions, we have things like SVG, which are vector icons and graphics that can be scaled to any size. So it doesn't matter what the quality of the resolution or what the resolution of the device is, it's always gonna look crisp. And then responsive images help us out from a bitmap standpoint to deliver the most appropriate image to the user based on the current device and the amount of screen real estate available. For brightness, we have the ability to tweak the contrast of our text on background and stuff like that. I'll give some more examples of that shortly. For color density, thinking about what our color choices are. And there's also actually some media queries you can use around this as well if you want to be able to tweak your design in different color scenarios. I'm going to skip user preference and circle back to that momentarily. But finally, we have the network speed and quality, which we can address with responsive images. We can address things like system fonts instead of loading custom fonts, which tend to be very heavy. So all of those are ways to address things. So what I've left out here is user preference and assistive technology, and that's because they're a little bit deeper to get into. Now, for user preference, people can set things like differently sized fonts. And for that reason, you might want to consider doing media queries that are based on M's. M's are based on, are there a relative size? So what's neat about using M-based media queries is that you can have an interface that, let's say, somebody is on a 7-inch tablet, let's say, and they bump up the font size. Instead of being a smaller two-column layout, when the text gets larger, it can switch to more of that mobile large text view. And so you're not forcing users to scroll side to side simply because they enlarge their fonts. For high contrast colors, there's actually a couple of options within Windows where you can actually tie into the high contrast settings within Windows itself. So -ms-high contrast active, that if that if somebody has turned on high contrast, whatever the mode is, we can apply certain styles in those contexts. We can do the same thing for white on black specifically or black on white specifically. So there's some neat things that we can do there. And then if somebody has a vestibular disorder, for instance, which affects around 70 million people, we can actually provide reduced motion. So remove the animations, remove the transitions and stuff that may cause them issues by using the prefers reduced motion media query, which is pretty cool. So, and then on the accessibility end of things, we have things like screen magnifiers, screen readers, braille printers, refreshable braille displays, and high contrast settings, which help people who have vision issues. For people that have motor or mobility issues, we have things like speech recognition, mouse settings, keyboards or keyboard overlays, as well as eye tracking devices. There's also foot pedals and straws and all sorts of other tools that people can use if they have motor impairments. And then for hearing, we have things like captioning and subtitling, which we should be considering. So with all of these kind of things to consider in the accessibility space, it can be a little daunting. It can seem like quite a challenge. And it's unlikely that you'll ever be able to consider that your product is 100% accessible, right? But every barrier you remove improves life for somebody when they're using your product. And that's an important thing to remember. And it's easy to remove a lot of the kind of low-hanging fruit barriers by starting to think about things like color, right? The colors that we choose matter. About 2% of men and about 0.5% of women suffer from a form of red-green color blindness. So thinking about the colors that we use and making sure that we're not using color alone to convey information is really important. This is also super important if you do any sort of charting on the web, making sure that you don't just have colors to convey what a particular line or a bar is. You want to have patterns in there too, so it becomes easier for somebody to tell what it is that they're looking at. Similarly, we want to have good color contrast. And actually, the creator of this tool, Leia Veru, is right up there in the audience. I didn't expect to see her here, but shout out to you, Leia. Thank you. There are a lot of great tools out there for testing the contrast of your text. This is one of them. There's a link to it in the bottom there. Highly recommend doing that. That ensures that your content is readable. If you are referring, this happens quite a bit in interfaces where people say, click the green button below. It's not very helpful if somebody has red-green color blindness, first of all. But there are possibilities with all the differences of layouts and such and responsive designs. That button may not actually be below in certain instances, right? So we can do things like actually anchoring directly to that button or anchoring directly to that figure. So that's what this code shows here. Here we have a reference to a figure and then the figure further on in the markup, and we can actually anchor right down to that using an ID reference. This can be especially useful to people who are using the keyboard to tab through content. Helps them to move from place to place. It's important to provide ample space around interactive elements. Now, Microsoft, Apple, Google, and many others have guidelines, HCI guidelines, about how to design buttons. Everyone debates over what the amount of space is you need between things and so on and so forth. I'll let you read up on that. But it's good to consider how much space you have between buttons so people don't click the wrong button, especially if maybe they have a tremor or something that makes it a little bit more difficult for them to click on things, or if they have really fat fingers like I do, right? We also should consider what our designs leave unsaid, and I think this is not employed often enough, honestly. We make a lot of assumptions about somebody's ability to visually connect elements on a page, but in non-visual interfaces, which is what Cortana and Alexa and such are, in addition to screen readers, we need to be thinking about how do we provide more information, more context around links that we're providing. So something that says finish reading, you might have 7 links on the page that all say finish reading. And visually, those are connected to teasers on the page. But as somebody is moving through that document link to link, they don't have that same context. So we can provide that context, though, by adding additional content into the link. This could be accomplished in a variety of ways. This is a simple way to do it, using a B element with a class of hidden, which you then find a way to accessibly hide that content. But now the link actually reads, you can finish reading, the web should just work for everyone in less than 10 minutes. Okay? And from a visual standpoint, we can hide those things that are in the B, and for a sighted user, it just says finish reading. Okay? Again, it's all about enhancing that experience for our users as we have opportunities to do so. So the next example I want to show you, or the next thing I want to cover, rather, is how we can actually use CSS itself to enhance our designs based on the capabilities of the particular browser we're in or the vintage of the browser. And I'm going to start off with a simple example of rule-based overrides. So in this example here, I have a paragraph with a color of green, and then I have another green that is at 80% using RGBA. Now, older browsers that don't understand RGBA values will simply ignore them. They'll ignore that second rule, and they will apply the green color to the paragraph. Okay? But if a browser comes along that does understand RGBA, it will override the original value of green with that RGBA value, which is 80% green. Okay? So this is just a super simple example, somewhat contrived. You're probably not going to be overriding greens, although it is something that you should be aware of if you're doing colors and you're only using RGBA and not providing a fallback. Some users may end up with just black text. So if you've got it on a black background, that can be a problem. So providing fallbacks if you're using any sort of alpha transparent colors is generally a good idea. But this is a simple example of overrides. This is somewhat similar to how the Flex CSS overrides, or rather causes the browser to throw out float-related styles and so on and so forth. Moving up to the actual declaration block itself, here we have this selects an H1 that has an adjacent paragraph, in case you're not familiar with the has selector. So this is using a very, very modern CSS selector. So there aren't a whole lot of browsers that support this yet. So any browser that does not support has would ignore this entire rule set. Okay, but a browser that does understand it would apply the rule set. So the selectors that we choose matter. And this actually also applies in the context of selectors being grouped together. So when you separate selectors by commas, if any of those selectors are not understood, the entire block gets ignored. So just be aware when you're using combined selectors like that. Taking it up another level, we can use media queries. So in this case, at media only screen. So the only keyword was introduced along with media queries. So this could apply to multiple rules. If a browser doesn't support media queries, it will ignore that entire block. So any rule sets that are inside that at media declaration. If a browser does support media queries, then it'll apply it. And obviously, the same thing holds true if we were to put a really complex selector in here. If the browser understood media queries but didn't understand the complex selector, it would still throw it out, and so on and so forth. So we're just kind of going up. A similar block that we have actually allows us to test for specific features to be supported in the browser, the at supports block. So in this case, we can test to see whether the browser supports display grid, so the CSS grid spec. If the browser doesn't understand at supports, which is a relatively new construct in CSS, it will ignore that block entirely. If it supports at supports but doesn't support display grid, it would ignore the contents of that block. And then if it does understand grid and it understands at supports, it can apply both. So this can be used to selectively deliver certain styles to certain classes of browser, which can be really helpful. Now, all of this works because HTML and CSS are built to be fault tolerant. In other words, browsers are instructed to ignore what they don't understand, which allows us to enhance our designs and layouts and start to use new elements and start to use new CSS without running the risk of breaking the layout or the design in older browsers or browsers that we maybe haven't considered. And new specs are smartly overriding old browsers that would have conflicting syntax. So that's what enables the demo that Manuel put together. So Flexbox throws out float, grid throws out float and Flexbox. Okay, so it's all about enhancing as we can. Now, I talked a little bit about mobile first earlier, and I just want to give a quick rundown of why approaching design from a mobile first standpoint is a really good idea. So this is, a very simplistic example, and I'm going to use old school CSS in case there are some folks who aren't super up on Flexbox and Grid. But let's say I just wanted to have two columns on a wide screen and one column in a small screen, right? Fairly common scenario. If I were to approach this from the desktop first, so I took my desktop CSS and I was like, okay, I'm going to add some media queries to make this work on a smaller screen, what you end up doing is having your primary and secondary divs, let's say, floating next to each other as your main code, and then you end up writing additional code to undo those styles, right, which is not terribly efficient. And you end up having to do that with the max width media query. If instead we switch from mobile-first perspective, we're using the default styles that are applied in the browser, which are to display those divs one on top of another as blocks, and then only apply the floated layout when it's appropriate to do so, using a min-width media query rather than a max-width one. So it allows us to write less code. We're not having to constantly undo styles that we've created. And it's just more additive. It's more about thinking about design as an enhancement and enhancing the design as we have more real estate or different capabilities. Other ways we can think about design from a mobile-first perspective include selectively delivering advanced styles. So one way to do this is to provide a basic mobile-first style sheet, so where you're assuming everything is just stacked on top of one another, and then giving a separate advanced style sheet but limiting it to only browsers that understand media queries by applying a media equals only screen, for instance, to that link element. So that way you could deliver to, let's say, IE8 and below, you could still support those browsers. You don't have to optimize for them. You don't even really have to test in them because you're just delivering them a baseline, you know, here are some font adjustments, here are some size of text adjustments, but that's about it, this very, very baseline mobile experience. And you can deliver that great experience to more modern browsers that understand media queries. You can also isolate CSS images within min-width media queries, because if the media query doesn't apply, the image won't be downloaded. Whereas if you start from desktop first, and then you keep swapping images or removing them or putting display none on them as you move smaller and smaller, in many cases, users are having to download those additional images even if they're not seeing them. So that can be problematic from a performance standpoint. It's a hidden tax on the user. Don't hide content images using CSS. Please do not do that. Again, a tax on the user, they don't see them. Use responsive images. The picture element and the source set and sizes attributes on the image element are both great enhancements that can help you to provide the most appropriate image to the user, and you actually just let the browser decide on what the most appropriate size image is to use. Prefer using system fonts. So if you can avoid using a custom typeface, please do. Those are really big, especially if you don't subset them. Or use something like Font Display Optional, which can allow your user to download the font sort of in the background when they load the first page, but it won't be applied until the second page they load. so they're not ending up with that weird flash of font shifting. Again, thinking about enhancing the experience, enhancing the user experience with design as a tool. So once we've used design, we can move on to using JavaScript to enhance our experiences for our users, enhancing that core experience. Now, as I mentioned, when it comes to HTML and CSS, browsers ignore what they don't understand. Sadly, that's not the case with JavaScript. Because JavaScript is a programming language, rules don't apply. Different set of rules apply. It's a program. It has to be interpreted. So consider the let keyword. The let keyword was introduced in ECMAScript 2015, or ES6, depending on what you like to call it. But basically what I've got going on here is I have a couple of writes that are taking place to the document body. So can I count to four? And then I'm going to inject paragraphs counting to four using the let keyword inside of that for loop, right? And let just allows that variable to be scoped just to that block if you're not familiar. And then output a success message at the end. So in pretty much, well, no, in every modern browser, you get what you expect, right? You have these paragraphs injected into the document. No problem. But in any browser that doesn't understand the let keyword, and granted, they're not used that often anymore, but any browser that doesn't understand them gets none of the JavaScript. So it doesn't even just ignore that little bit that used the let, right? It ignores the entirety of the JavaScript. It just fails. And browsers that fall into this category would include everything from IE10 and below, Opera Mini, which is about 5% globally, the Android browser, the native browser, not Chrome, the QQ browser. And this is just an example of one simple keyword, right? But because the interpreter doesn't know what to do with that, it throws out the entire program because it has no idea how to build it. So again, more dependencies, more potential problems, right? This sort of stuff can happen. And if your entire experience of your website or your product depends on JavaScript, you can run into issues, right? And it's important because I've had some people say to me, well, my analytics shows that we don't have any users that are no JavaScript. And then my first question to them is, well, does your analytics software use JavaScript to record that information? And many of them scratch their chins and say, well, yes. There you go. Now, you can track that sort of thing. I'm happy to discuss that afterwards. Don't have time to discuss how to do that right now. But if we think and approach JavaScript from a thoughtful standpoint and we use it intentionally, we can actually embrace the idea of enhancing our experiences and create really, really robust experiences using JavaScript without sacrificing the core experience that works for anybody in any situation. So depending on your project setup, simply enabling server-side rendering and routes to handle links and actions if JavaScript fails is a relatively easy baseline. And then you can download your JavaScript application code and take over the whole experience when you know it can run. There are quite a few companies that do this. Airbnb is one of them. So your enhancement may look like this, right? So you've got a baseline site that works with links and with forms that actually submit, but then you have this, you know, stellar experience that uses a JavaScript framework, front-end JavaScript framework. You can also do it at the feature level. So as an example, consider WebAuthn. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, it's a relatively new spec that actually allows you to use public-private key combinations where the browser is interacting with the OS. So it's not relying on SMS texts or other things that could be hacked, for instance. So not only does it provide a more secure method of logging in terms of authentication methods, but it also makes it much easier for users to be getting authenticated in sites. And WebAuthn is actually something that we'll be supporting in the next release of Windows. So I'm going to show you a quick demo here. Here we have a store demo that uses WebAuthn, and they've recently introduced it, right? So I'm already logged into the store, and I have a credit card on file. When I choose to purchase a product and check out with a card I already have on file with them, it prompts me for my password first. I enter that password so the site knows that I am who I say I am, And it also notices that my browser supports WebAuthn. So at that point, Edge can negotiate with Windows to get authentication data from the Windows Hello service, for instance, or it could be a fingerprint reader or any other sort of biometric, or an RSA token or something like that. And once the browser has that data, the site can use the WebAuthn API to store the credential to the server for future authentication requests. So the next time I complete an action that requires authentication, I can use Windows Hello or another auth provider that's compatible with the API, which is pretty cool. So in order to use something like this, we first need to test to see whether the particular tool is available. So in this case, I want to check for credential support. And there's additional levels of checking you can do as well. And I'm not going to get into the weeds of how to create credentials and stuff. This is way above my pay grade. But we use the public key option in the WebAuthn API, or when we're creating the credential object, rather. And this allows us to basically create the key value or the public key private key pair. We submit that to the server, and then we're also able to authenticate that back for verification purposes later by grabbing the credential out of Navigator credentials. This would store it on the individual device that you're on. So what we end up with as an enhancement is maybe we have a normal password experience for as our baseline for folks with older devices or devices that aren't capable of using WebAuthn. And then we have the WebAuthn feature for folks who can take advantage of it. Now, OS level feature integration like this sounds like we're getting back kind of into that PWA territory. But the cool thing is that you don't actually need to be a PWA to take advantage of this. But speaking of PWAs, you might be wondering, okay, but don't progressive web apps and service workers require JavaScript? Well, yes, Service Worker requires JavaScript. It is written in JavaScript. But service workers were designed as an enhancement to existing web pages. They're not a requirement to use the page. So in order to register a service worker, we first want to query for whether service worker is even supported. So we have object detection to do that. And browsers know enough that they know what they don't know, right? So that's how we can test for object existence like this. We can test for objects we want to use. We can test for methods that we want to use. Sadly, keywords like let are a little different. So we have a normal site that can all of a sudden transform into being a PWA. Or if you want to think about it a little bit more granularly in terms of what Service Worker enables, we have a site, and then we have the PWA in the browser, and then maybe we have an installed PWA. Or to break it down even further, we have a site. We have a site that has less network reliance because Service Worker does a great job of allowing us to cache things. We have a site that's capable of working offline. We have a site that can do individual syncs back to the server, perhaps when network connectivity is available again. And we have the ability to send push notifications via our website. And then in the future, we might even be able to do things like periodic background syncs, where the site doesn't even need to be open, but it can be getting fresh data, like new news headlines or something like that. So all of these are levels of enhancement that can be done just within a service worker, which is pretty cool. And we'll get more features over time, I'm sure. And interestingly, when installed on Windows, PWAs can actually get access to a bunch of host level or host OS level capabilities that you wouldn't consider really for a normal website, like settings information, such as being able to switch into dark mode. So this API is a little cumbersome, so I'm going to walk through it a little bit at a time here. But first, we check for the existence of the Windows object as part of, or the yeah, the Windows object on the window, or the Windows namespace within the window in JavaScript. And so once we have that check in place, we know that if that goes through, if we go inside of that conditional, if that conditional is true, we know we are in an installed PWA in Windows. So then we can use those PWA, or those UWP, rather, APIs within our JavaScript. So the first thing I can do is get access to the UI settings. This is where I'll find information about the color. And then I can grab the background color that's currently set in UI settings. So that's where I can determine whether or not, whether it's black or white. So dark mode is black, light mode is white. And then I can test that object to see if it is in fact the black color, and then apply certain rules for that website or swap style sheets or add a class to the body or something like that that can toggle the website around. Now, I made a quick demo with a sideloadable version of this. You can check out the code and download it by following the link at the bottom. But basically what we have here is an example of a PWA that actually responds to switching back and forth between dark mode. There is an event that takes place when somebody switches, but I have not been able to get it to work in JavaScript yet. So, but it at least works the next time they open it up. So if somebody is constantly in dark mode, it would automatically open in dark mode. So people don't tend to toggle back and forth too much. So as I mentioned, we can and should use JavaScript, but we need to do so thoughtfully and intentionally. We need to be cognizant of the fact that somebody may not get our JavaScript-based enhancements, and that's okay. As long as we focus on that core experience and how we can enhance it, we're going to provide better experiences for our users. We should always be looking to enhance our users' experience, but not at the expense of a robust, universally available baseline. So, as I mentioned earlier, PWAs start with a great web experience and then enhance that experience for performance, resilience, installation, and engagement. And the most important thing is that we start with that great web experience. We build great web experiences by focusing on what matters, by using markup that supports that core experience, by designing in support of that core experience, and then using JavaScript to enhance that core experience to remove the UX friction. Thank you all very much. And I'm happy to take questions. We got about 9 minutes before the hook comes out to pull me off the stage. So if there are any questions, if you want to line up behind the microphone, we have one up here in the front and center. If not, enjoy the rest of your build and definitely check out the other PWA talks that are being given here. Thank you. Yes, the question is, so with Service Worker, is periodic sync coming? Yes, the spec is still in development, and so we're not at the point where we're comfortable enough with where it's at to have a timeline for when we're going to be implementing it, but we're watching it, and we are participating a lot in that area. So it will be coming in time. Yeah, it's a pretty cool feature, yes.
Just real quick, can you throw up the page that has all the other PWA app?
Yep. Question was, could I put up the other agenda ones here? Give me 1 second. There are the other sessions. All right, another question?
Yeah, so what are some of the hardware APIs that are coming to Edge, like USB support or RFIDs? When are those coming?
I mean, we're paying attention to a lot of them. Some of them are available via the WinRT APIs currently once your PWA is installed, but we are tracking things like Bluetooth API and some of the other APIs that are starting to kind of roll along. You can see, if you go to I think it's status.microsoftedge.com. We have a status board that'll actually run down kind of where we're at different specs in terms of, you know, whether it's under consideration, whether we're actively developing it, and that sort of stuff.
All right, excellent.
Yeah.
So my question was about using JavaScript progressively, mm-hmm. or I guess.
Yeah.
And how do you do that with React?
So in terms of using really any front-end JavaScript framework and trying to enhance in this way, a lot of times you honestly have to do a server-side render and just be able to handle the routes and have real form submissions and stuff like that. That's honestly sort of the approach that Airbnb have taken and that some of the other companies have taken. It's sometimes referred to as isomorphic JavaScript, where basically you're doing a server-side render, so you're always guaranteed that users are going to get some experience. And you're handling whatever you need to in order to make that work without your JavaScript framework loading, and then you load your JavaScript framework on top of that when it's able to. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Aaron. So this Windows.UI API you mentioned, is that available in every browser in Windows or just Edge?
So that particular API is one of the Windows RT APIs that's available once you're installed. So if you're an installed PWA, that's when those open up to you.
Ah, thanks.
So if you want to test your site for accessibility, what are some good screen reader tools to use to make sure that it's accessible for people so that you can test it out?
So I mean, testing in the actual screen readers that people use are the best ideas. So getting copies of JAWS and such a really good narrator. Turning off your monitor and trying to browse the site with a screen reader is really helpful. Narrator actually has a developer mode, which is pretty cool, where it will actually black out just the app that you're currently interacting with. And for Edge, what it'll look like is it'll actually, as you move your focus pointer around using the tab key, so using your keyboard, it will visually show you where you are on the page and show you like what the text is that would be read out, but it obviously also read it to you. But those can be really helpful. I don't know. There are a couple of other good tools out there. Keros is one that we've created internally, and I want to say it's public. It's K-E-R-O-S, and it can actually be used to debug anything, including web and native within Windows, and it provides all of the accessibility mapping so that you can see how things are working. Most browser dev tools are starting to expose the accessibility APIs now, so you can see what an element is being exposed as, so you can see if it's actually registering as a button or not. So that then means that it becomes automatable. So you could use WebDriver and stuff like that to check accessibility mappings, which can be quite useful as well.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Yep.
Cool. So this one I'm just more curious on because they seem to serve pretty similar purposes, but what would you say are the main differences between the M unit and like viewport units? Because at least when it comes to responsive text, I find that viewport, like with, for example, with the calc function in CSS, seems to do the trick a little more smoothly than the M unit.
Totally agree. Like viewports and calc and being able to have sort of percentage-based things, all of that's fantastic in browsers that support them. M has support way back to the beginning. So, I mean, you could provide that baseline M-based media queries, and then for font sizing and stuff, you could use viewport widths and things. Or you could use rem if you want to just have everything based on the HTML element as opposed to on the parent element and stuff like that. Because M's can get a little tricky when you're doing nesting.
Yeah.
But M units for media queries is really easy. You know, you don't have to get into all that crazy calculation. And then, yeah, you can do your font sizing and scaling and stuff using calc and viewport width and all that stuff.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Combinations are good.
Sweet.
Yeah. Any other questions? All right. Thank you all very much.